Welcome, members and guests, to the January 9th program of the City Club of Eugene, honoring the resiliency of American Indians. Thank you for joining us, and greetings to our broadcast television and radio audiences. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Sacred Earth Botanicals, Essex General Construction. We develop partnerships as strong and sturdy as the buildings we construct, and PAC Info Internet Solutions. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the webcasts on their site. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please do join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. We also welcome your contributions to our new Special Events Fund, which we're kicking off this spring with a program by the first female justice of the United States Supreme Court, the Honorable Sandra Day O'Connor. We'd like to welcome our new members, Eileen O'Malley and Steve Dwight. From January to March this year, City Club will again be partnering with Lane Workforce Partnership and Lane ESD to offer a free course for teachers focused on the local economy and employment opportunities. The course includes visits to local companies where our young people might invest their talents. Lane County educators can find out more and sign up on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Today's program, Honoring the Resiliency of American Indians, is coordinated by Mary Layton, who will introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Jason Yonker is Assistant Vice President and first ever advisor to the President on the Sovereignty and Government-to-Government Relations at the University of Oregon. Yonker is a member of the Coquille Nation, and he earned his doctoral and master's degrees at the university. After working there and guiding the construction of the Many Nations Longhouse on campus, he accepted a position at the Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York in 2004. There, Jason built a program for Native American students that emphasized academic and social support called the Native American Future Stewards Program. The program was modeled around the values of he had a very high success rate and he increased. My cut and paste didn't work so well. He was recently became the first Oregonian to win the Eli S. Parker Award from the American Indian Science and Engineering Society for his outstanding work in increasing the representation of American Indians and Alaskan Natives in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. Jason has some significant ambitions for the Native talent in this state, to make its contribution stronger to our work as a community. And today he's going to talk a little bit about the history of his people and others and what his plans are for the future. Our first responder today is Mayor Kitty Piercy, because Jason has a couple of ideas that Mayor Piercy may be able to help us figure out how to pursue. Jason?
Well, thank you. It's my privilege and honor to be here this afternoon. I'm very happy to say that after 20 years, I finally made it to the gym. I grew up in South Slough, Coos Bay, Oregon, not very far from where Mark Helfrich grew up, and Prefontaine, and so I'm very pleased to be part of that Coos Bay contingency that has made the University of Oregon hopefully a little bit better. I'm a member of the Coquille Indian tribe and have been since 1988. In fact, before that time, I wasn't allowed to call myself Indian because the federal government said that we weren't. My chief calls me up to his hips in water, and that's because I have the privilege of returning the first salmon back to the river, our cousins back to the river, so that they will return to us each and every year. And unfortunately, in Oregon, the water is very cold, and I actually do have to go up to my hips in water. I have a very long title, perhaps the longest title at the University of Oregon and in the history of the University of Oregon, but I have a lot of responsibilities that go with that. I am the president's eyes and ears. I'm his liaison to the 9 federally recognized tribes who are currently in Oregon, but also to the 42 external tribes that have Aboriginal ties to Oregon. So, for example, the Modoc, who are now in Oklahoma, actually are from southern Oregon and northern California. We recognize that these state boundaries, these political boundaries, didn't exist for many Native Americans and only was an imposition later. So the University of Oregon is really progressive in this area, and I'm very pleased to be part of a university that recognizes that there are these 51 tribes that are from Oregon, but part of a group of 566 that exist in the United States today. Native Americans are the most underrepresented affinity group at college campuses. We have the poorest retention and the poorest graduation rates. Less than 50% of us graduate from high school. Of that 50%, only 1% attend college. The dropout rates are incalculable. The people who actually graduate from college and go on to graduate degrees, it's so minor, so minuscule, that it is disheartening, and it's lonely as a Native American on these college campuses. I'm very happy that at the University of Oregon, we're doing much more than simply opening our doors and hoping that people come through, hoping that those tribal representatives, those tribal ambassadors come to our university. We are actually working in their communities, not only as different departments and colleges, but also as the first university in the state to have the position that I now hold. So I'm very proud not only of the University of Oregon, but also of the community members here in Eugene that insisted that this type of position exist. We have a tremendous amount of challenges ahead of us, but I see it as a very optimistic sense of where we are going in the future. Today, my talk is very brief. I'm probably going to leave you with many more questions than there are answers. It's hard to go over U.S. history, Native American experience in just 20, 25 minutes, but we will cover as much as we can today. The discovery and conquering and settlement of North America and South America is not as heroic and glamorous as we know it today through our history books. And there is much more to celebrate in the resiliency of indigenous peoples, not only here in the Americas, but also globally, as many people try to recover from what happened through the eras of colonialism. Being Native American is not a definition that Native Americans control. It's a definition that the U.S. government controls. They tell us what it is that allows us to be Native American. You have to be enrolled to be Native American. Sometimes you even have to have a blood quantum to be Native American. Blood quantum was introduced in the 1930s and even a little bit before that, and was a statistical method to eliminate Indians over time as they began to marry outside of their tribes and with other tribes, and eventually lowering their blood quantum so that they would not actually meet the minimum requirements of being an enrolled tribal member. So it was an imposition by the United States. Some of these still exist today. Blood quantum is misunderstood a lot of times by people who they ask you, what is your lineage, what is your heritage, and then the next question out of their mouth is, well, how much Indian are you? And people look at me and they think, well, gosh, he looks like he's full-blooded. Well, the reality is I'm not. And I'm very happy that I am as much as I am. And I'm very happy, even though as a child growing up, didn't appreciate it very much, I'm happy that I look the way that I am. Because, you know, right now it's cool to be Indian. It's cool to get the gray hairs and look like you're a wise old Indian, too. My wife would have something to say about that. But I'm very proud that I descend from peoples who survived conditions that I can barely begin to imagine. What happened here in Oregon was a tragedy. It was our Holocaust. What happened in the United States was a Holocaust. And if you consider what happened in America, it is the greatest act of genocide that happened when you compare it to other things that happened globally. So if we look at history and we start to calculate everything that happened, we have to go back to who discovered, and I put quotations around that, who discovered these two very large continents. So when I was in New York, we challenged our Native American students to be very proud in a Columbus Day, but to help other peoples understand what Columbus Day meant to them. And they came up with some really creative ideas. The first year, we made these cards, and they looked like Discover cards. And we stood out on the path where all the students walked by, and we handed them to everybody and said, congratulations, you've been discovered. And then on the flip side, it said, I bet you didn't even know you were lost. Next year, we had T-shirts that said, got land, thank an Indian. You know, and every year it progressed to something more and more exciting, to where our Native students were really, really looking forward to Columbus Day, and which was so much different than when I grew up, when you think about what happened after Columbus Day and all the things that you were asked to forget about as you studied history. It was so much fun watching the kids discover the president of our university and the provost and all of the students that walk by. And the next thing you know, we not only have the Native students, but we have the general students coming out and supporting us. And that was a much more positive way than simply being angry and holding up signs and saying, this is horrible. It is a wonderful way to see creativity come out of our tribal youth to confront something that bothers them. And that's what I'm going to challenge all of us to do by the time I get to the end of this. Okay. I've got a timer here, but my phone keeps on going dark, so I'll expect somebody to go like this. So Columbus gets lost, 1492. He discovered these massive continents of 100 million people. And the Catholic Church is baffled by all of this because previously they thought the world was flat, and now they've got 100 million people that they don't know how to explain. So it took them 27 years, but finally Pope Sixtus V, as irony would have it, he declared us to be human, thank goodness. We were human, but we were savages, and we needed to be saved. So he declared that missionaries or people go out and save these Indians, and by using military force, save these people from themselves. At the same time, colonization and extraction of the New World's resources were taking place, settlements were taking place, and manifest destiny was the norm. Those people with God could inherit the earth, and everybody else who wasn't needed to be removed. removal being a very generic term, a very liberally applied term of getting rid of, not just putting in locations that are out of the way. Our forefathers, said George Washington, they are beasts of prey. John Adams said, they are poor, ignorant savages. Thomas Jefferson, I hope we shall drub the Indians well into this summer and then change our plan from war to bribery. Bribery ended up being treaties. There are 300-some treaties that were formally recognized by the federal government. Of course, 100% of those were violated. But there were many, many more, especially the treaties out west, that were negotiated in good faith but were never ratified by Congress. As you see up here, I have a map. It's a map of the western United States. The actual map is quite large. And when I was growing up, I was told, well, you're not Indian because they lost the map. And I never really knew what that meant. And people always said, well, they lost the map, you're not Indian, because the government says so. And I really had a hard time explaining to not only friends, but even kids in school, who are you? Are you Hawaiian? Well, no. Are you Asian? I said, well, I'm the tallest one, I guess. And I would tell them that I'm German. And, you know, the Indians and the Germans had to live right next to each other because nobody liked the Germans at the time of the World Wars, and nobody liked the Indians, so we ended up living in the same slums and intermarrying. And nobody would really believe me when I said that I was German. But that's the only thing that I could pass for because nobody would actually believe that I was Coquel, that I was Native American. And I was always told that this map, which depicts all of the locations of Oregon's tribes and the location of where the Great Coast Reservation was supposed to be, that this map was to accompany all of the Palmer treaties that were negotiated in the 1850s. Unfortunately, those Palmer treaties went unratified by Congress. They were sent to Congress by mail separately. And the treaties made it to Congress, but the map was lost in mail. And so when people told me, oh, you're not Indian because they lost the map, they were literally saying that the map was lost. Well, when I was in graduate school here at the University of Oregon, I participated in a research project where it was partially funded by the university, the Smithsonian, and my tribe. And they sent us to the archives, the National Archives and the National Anthropological Archives, to look for things that may reveal to us a crisper picture of our colonial history. Because everything after the 1850s really is, for us, a colonial history. Everything before that, as the court said, is all hearsay. Generations of hearsay. So when we were there, my brother and I went to the National Archives II in College Park, Maryland, which is where the maps are located. And we started thumbing through everything that had anything to do with Oregon, and we came across this large, large map, and we started looking at it, and we were, oh, there's the Coquel, and here's all of the bands, and there's 61 bands of natives within the state of Oregon, and they had them designated by first class, second class, third class. Luckily, the South Coast was first class. And we started looking at this. My sister-in-law's in she's Warm Springs, and they were qualified as third class, so I never let her forget that. And so we started looking at this map, and we looked at each other, and we realized at exactly the same moment that this was the map that was to accompany our treaties. It was because this map was lost that Congress said, we don't have the map, and we're not going to consider the treaties, the Palmer Treaties of Oregon, until we have the map that accompanies it. And it shows us exactly where the Indians are going, where the treaty provisions are going to be sent. The map was lost for 2 years back in the 1850s, and by that time, everybody who had been pre-removed to the reservation, removed from harm's way to the reservations, ran away. The Indian problem was over. So there was no reason to confront those treaties, and the map was lost away, locked away into this archive. So several months later, my brother and I returned. We recovered about 60,000 pages of information about Oregon natives, and most specifically those on the southern Oregon coast. And our tribal council called us in and they said, okay, tell us what you did and why we spent so much money on all of this. And so we unveiled this map and we explained to them how we had grown up hearing that we were not Indian because the map was lost. And people wept. To actually be able to see and touch the very document that determined a horrible, horrible existence for 100 years until 1988 when the government actually said, oh, you are Indians. To actually touch and feel that meant something to my brother and I. It meant something to all of the natives, all of the Coquel that were in the room. We ended up potlatching this map and other documents to all of the tribes in Oregon and some of the tribes in Northern California. And the same experience for them was very similar to the one and the history that the Coquels experienced. Being able to touch it, being able to know why you were not Indian until a much later date, a much later time period when civil rights was happening and when people were asserting their heritage and their beliefs and humanity was on the rise. That is something to celebrate. Celebrating we should recognize the tragedies of history, but we should always celebrate what has happened after that. This is a great time to be Native American. We are finally able to say we are Coquel. The 9 federally recognized tribes are finally healing from everything that happened. Everything that happened prior to even the settlement of Oregon. The diseases got here first. By the time David Douglas walked down the Willamette Valley, it was almost barren. He walked through the Willamette Valley and he saw meticulously cared for camas fields, which is a starchy bulb. You'll see them every May. And he said it looked like the second Salt Lake, the second Great Lake. And he found it to be similar to the Garden of Eden, his idea of the Garden Eden. This place held many, many natives. And we can't even calculate because of those diseases. But now we are finally recovering. We are finally learning all of the little things that have been hidden from us for all of these years. And it's becoming a source of pride that we survived. I tell my students that are considering college, they say, I don't know if I want to go to college. I hear that it's traumatic, and we all hold this post-traumatic stress of what American education has meant to us. It was a place where they killed the Indian and they saved the man. That was their intent, to make us more like somebody else. And I tell them that, you know, at college, if you have the opportunity, is not a choice. It's your responsibility. It's your responsibility to honor those who survived. An honor to serve as a descendant of those who survived and those who sacrificed everything that they did. I hope that as we consider what to do next, that we follow the lead of Seattle. Seattle has chosen to celebrate resiliency, celebrate Indigenous, and to do so at their community level. Eugene has been this wonderful, wonderful place for me. It's been a place for change. It's been a place where we avoid indifference and we think deeply about not only ourselves and where we fit in this world, but also where how we impact those around us. I challenge all of us to think of that second Monday in October as something other than the beginning of a Native American Holocaust. Columbus was a wonderful, great discoverer of things. And I'm not proposing that we replace it, but that we celebrate Indigenous Resiliency Day on that second Monday. And that's all I have for you. Go Ducks!
Thanks, Jason. And now our Mayor Kitty Piercy will respond to that challenge to follow Seattle's lead.
Hi. So I was saying earlier when we were talking before the speech that I just received probably 25 letters from North Eugene High School students because they've all been going through being taught about how to think about Columbus Day differently. And so I have all of those to answer. So this is a very timely meeting because I will take what you have brought and that will inform how I answer them. They're asking that question. They are asking, how can we celebrate or recognize Columbus Day in a different way? So I think this is somewhat what you call a moment. So I was asked to say how you would go about doing that. So here is how. Many of you know this, but some might not. There are several avenues available to individuals or groups requesting official action on an issue or initiative. The primary way is to contact a city councilor and request that he or she become an advocate of the issue. The councilor may agree to issue a work session poll to explore the issue and determine if there's enough council support to pursue further action. Work session polls must receive 4 votes for approval. So if, for instance, one counselor says, this is something I care passionately about, and they get 3 others to agree, then we'll have that discussion. The other thing, and I think this is really important, and I tell people to do this all the time, because I think since we have our council meetings on TV, you should take advantage of that. That's an opportunity to educate the public. And so one thing you can do is come and take up your 3 minutes, or if you want more than 3 minutes, bring more people and they each get 3 minutes, and talk about the issue and inform the whole community. And I would say perhaps your vehicle could be those North Eugene High School students, along with college mentors, perhaps. And so that's a second way to do it. And then usually what happens with that is that a counselor gets fired up about it and wants to pursue it. So those are 2 different ways, or you can do both. And then the other is the initiative process. And of course, the advantage of the initiative process is you really go through educating the whole community in a broader and deeper sense. So legal staff may advise a council on what type of council action is appropriate if a counselor should take it up. It could be an ordinance, a rule or law established by the organization to regulate itself and its citizens. The ordinance requires at least 1 public hearing, so if you want to make it official, it could be, or it could be a resolution, a written motion adopted by the council, which refers to measures that do not become laws. The resolution is often used to express the body's approval or disapproval of something which they cannot otherwise vote on due to the matter being handled by another jurisdiction or being protected by a constitution. An example would be a resolution of support for the nation's troops in battle, which carries no legal weight but is adopted for moral support. Or the council could choose to do a letter of support, When formal action by the council is impossible or inadvisable, council may agree to send an official letter of support to another body, for example, the state, that may have influence on decision-making authority over the change requested at the higher and broader level. The initiative process is part of Eugene's system of direct legislation by voters. In Eugene, an initiative petition may propose one of three types of legislation: revise or amendment of the Eugene Charter, ordinance enacting a law of a permanent or general character which creates policy as opposed to executing policy already in existence, or a protected ordinance in accordance with the Eugene Charter. Any elector may initiate legislation by filing with Eugene City Recorder a prospective initiative petition proposing new legislation and requesting that it be submitted to the electors of the city. Once an initiative is certified to have sufficient signatures, the measure is scheduled to be voted on at the first primary or general election to be held not sooner than 90 days after the certification with the following, and that's pretty much it. So I think you'd have to think about what you want and the best vehicle for, if you want, you might want all of the above in a sense, because I think the issue here is for the city of Eugene and all the people who live here to show what they want to have happen in terms of how they want to express that national day. And so these vehicles are open to you and open to the public, and we'll be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Jason Younger and Mayor Piercy, and we'll break now for a few minutes to have the audience formulate their questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the January 9th City Club program honoring the resiliency of American Indians. City Club members, please identify yourself before asking your question. And thank you all very much.
Hi. Hi, Jason. I'm Roz Stein, City Club member. I was wondering, well, first of all, I do want to say that this was a wonderful talk. I wanted it to go on and on. I didn't want you to stop.
Tell my wife that.
Okay, I will. It was great. We were wondering at our table, you know, what would be the plan to educate teachers to present history as it was and with the attitude of Native American resiliency? In other words, is there a teacher education plan that...
The Grand Ronde have been actually quite proactive in this, and they have started putting together curriculum that, and right now they're in K through 4 and are working on a curriculum for older age groups. But the tribes themselves, now that they are finding themselves economically healthy, and in many ways that you know, we're able to do these things, and we're able to tell our own stories. There was a time when anthropology would not allow myself study Coquels because how can you be unbiased in your observation? But today it's much different. It's about who better to describe and write about yourself and your tribe. So I think it's going to get much better in the years to come. I think people are starting to read, and teachers are becoming more responsible in the stuff that they're teaching. So I'm very optimistic about that. I hope that all the teachers that are watching this would dig deeper and don't be afraid to share this horrible history, because we really do have to recognize that it happened before we can begin to heal from that. And we don't want things like this to repeat themselves. And you all know the saying. So I think it's going to get better. How do you do that? That's a challenge that Indian Education, the Education Association, Oregon Education Association needs to tackle. It has to be at the forefront.
So. I'd just say also that in the story I told you about North Eugene, this is the second year that that's been the topic. So it is something that it's being talked about. I don't know, though, whether they're getting the resiliency piece as much as the historic piece. So there is some issue there about bringing forward the notion of resilience and a hopeful and positive future.
I'm Jerry Smith, City Club member, retired social worker. And I've lived in California, Hawaii, Washington State, and Oregon, and have paid attention to indigenous people in all those situations. And I find that discrimination against people like that, the way the court system people treats indigenous people, is quite like the one that we're seeing now on the national level, where black people are filling way too many spots. They're being over policed and mistreated. One of the things that I see happening is that they're beginning to look to one another as community. I know. These questions are hard to form. That they're beginning to form an additional community, like when Al Sharpton put together the families that were had lost people by police killing. And when they got together, they said, this is the first time where we've been celebrated. This is the first time we've been community. And I'd really love to see that happen among not only these identified, quote, tribes. I'm attached to the DNA tribes, where we're Germans, and quite a few other people are considered tribes as well. So I'd like to see that the diversity be accepted and people come together and do exactly what you've done today, make people proud.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm Marjorie Ramey, City Club member. Our table was interested in the education in the various reservations. Mm-hmm. You described there was very low graduation from high school, and then even lower entering to or graduation from the universities or higher education. What can be done about the preparation back where they are, where we are, to bring better people, better prepared people into these situations? How would you recommend this be solved?
Education on the reservations is changing dramatically. I was at a groundbreaking, or actually an opening, for the Warm Springs tribe. They just recently partnered with the towns out there to build a school right on the reservation. And it's a fantastic school that has 100% Native American population. Its education is changing for Native Americans. We are now thinking of it as a way to better ourselves, but we hit a point where we're afraid to go beyond. So having education on the reservation is much different than leaving and going to some place where it's foreign. When I first got married, my wife is Irish and Italian, and we walked through the Chicago airport, and she said, I can't believe, I never noticed how many people stare. And I said, well, that's been my whole entire life. Look at me, I'm 6'4". They stare all the time and wonder who I am, when what I am. And so she said that she had never been part of a minority group. That is one, if you can imagine yourself leaving the comfort of your community and then finding yourself as the only one. That's what these first-generation Native American students find themselves in. And I remember going to college. I couldn't find any other Indians, and I certainly couldn't find any Native American professors. It was lonely. We die of loneliness on college campuses. It's much different today. At RIT, there were 22,000 students, Rochester Institute of Technology, where I taught before. There were 32 Native Americans. We created a program, and by the time I left 7 years later, there were 142 Native Americans. The first year that we had the Future Stewards program, I collected all of the names, and I said, what is your tribal affiliation? And there were 12 Mohawk Nation students. And I sent them all an email, and I said, did you know you are one of 12 Mohawk who are on campus? And I put all of their names in the send to list. And pretty soon they started hitting reply to all. By the end of the day, I must have had 500 emails. Who's your grandmother? Where'd you grow up? I said, please, take me off the list. Take me off the list. But it was exciting to watch Native students find others that look like them, think like them, are perhaps even related to them. That's how hard it is. And so when the University of Oregon built the Longhouse, it became the embassy for these Native students. And the student group on campus, Native American Student Union, is one of the strongest that I have ever seen in all of my years as a Native educator. Absolutely. This fall, we had the Oregon Indian Education Association come, and 90 students arrived, high school students, and we went to the flag ceremony together.
Well, tell them about that.
That's wonderful. Goodness. We raised 9 flags of the 9 federally recognized tribes in the center of campus. Mm-hmm. It has not been done anywhere else in the United States. And we walked with those 90 high school students from the Longhouse through the middle of campus to the EMU, where these flags were each raised individually by their chair.
That's just so.
And it was one of the proudest days of my life to see the kids walk through campus and not be afraid. That's how it has to be for, I mean, that's how it has to be before we're going to see a turnaround for Native Americans in education. We have to find that critical mass.
It's wonderful.
Okay. Hi, I'm Annie Kalish, and I'm from Oakley Meadow Co-Housing, one of the sponsors. I'm a Jew. I lost a lot of extended family in the Holocaust, and we had stories that helped us heal. And I'm just wondering if the Coquille had stories from that time that have been handed down. And, you know, some of our stories have been made into movies. And I'm just wondering if that's possible for your tribe or the tribes of Oregon.
I have a very good story. It's how my grandmother ran away from the reservation, because only those who were married to white men, actually it was illegal to be married to a white man, it still is. So my wife, she can be arrested later, I guess. Or no, it's illegal to be married to an Indian, sorry. Let me get that right. So only those married to a white man could stay in their Aboriginal territory. My grandmother, her husband, had since passed, and so she was removed to the reservation. She ran away from the reservation after a year, after 2 years, whatever it was, because of this lost map. The treaty provisions weren't coming. people without treaty provisions starved. So she ran away in the middle of the night. They sent the army after her. She made it down the beaches, walked up the rivers, grabbed bark or logs, swam across the rivers. She made it all the way down to Coos Bay, and she walked over the North Spit and floated her way down to about where the old Dairy Queen is in Empire, if you've been down there. And I asked my uncle told me this story, and I said, well, how come she came to that spot? And he said, well, she was tired. She wanted an ice cream cone. But she hid herself all the way up South Slough, which is where I grew up, on a location close to Valeno Island. And word was sent out that she was there, and her daughter would sneak away in the middle of the night and bring her food and clothing and take care of her until her husband became very suspicious and followed her and actually discovered that his mother-in-law was living in this hollow log, and so he brought her back to the house. And she lived underneath the house when the army would come. And so it's very, very similar stories to that. What is remarkable about that story is that she was completely blind and around 80 years old. So if you can imagine what the conditions were at the reservation to inspire somebody as feeble as she was to do all of that, I am inspired by that kind of story.
I'm a City Club member, Betsy Stephenson, and actually you've almost answered all three, which were educational. I have 12 grandchildren, so I'm very, well, I have 6 kids, so you know, but the possibilities have stopped. And I want to know a couple of things. One is the education thing. Is it a interest in parents of Native Americans? Like, I tell a lot of stories. Is it a tribal thing that they would all tell their grandchildren about the fact of what their identity is and where it came from? Is that a habit that parents have?
Well, it is a cautionary tale that is told with great sensitivity. If you know of Chamawa is just right up here. It used to be in Forest Grove. It's in Salem. It is the longest-running Indian boarding school. Now, my father's generation, he's 70-something, and he didn't have to go to boarding school. But boarding schools were required. They were required by all Indian children. And they were used, the American education system was used to separate and control, remove the kids from the reservations to control those who are on the reservations. And it was a very violent, violent education, which was passed on from one generation to the next. So it isn't very long ago that we have my grandparents being removed to boarding schools. Now, you would think that they would remove somebody from Southern Oregon coast up to Chamawa. But that's not the intent of boarding schools. It was for control. They sent us out to Haskell so that we couldn't visit. They sent Navajos and Lakotas and people from Alaska, Alaska Natives, to Chamawa. So that's the history, the American education system that we grew up with. And now you're 2 generations away from a boarding school that we're now finding that there are first-generation college students who are now coming into college. So, again, things are changing for the better. But you always have to go back to that history to understand why there has always been this American Indian education stigma, memory that has been horrible for us.
So as a member of City Club and League of Women Voters, what can we do to facilitate that the whole state of Oregon, and then we can spread out to Washington and whatever, California, has within the curriculum as just a regular thing? Like you talk about France, Germany, Native American, whatever, and really get that map, a copy of that map, in every school. in our state, and I'll sit down with you, figure out how we, of City Club members, can assist you.
Anybody have a checkbook? That would require a very long answer, but I thank you for challenging us to think about how we should go about doing this. And I think that we are getting to that spot where we can. And you guys are at the center of this, too.
I'd just like to add that I think one of the things that we really need to remember is how short history is. That a lot of the significant changes that have happened for Native Americans, but also for other populations, is not very long ago. It's a very short period of time between the way we were and the way we are. So there's a lot of work to do.
Well, thank you for your talk. I'm Deborah Healy, City Club member. This is a change of pace here. At our table, I mean, we hear that some Indian nations have been seeking recognition from the United Nations. Are you familiar with this? And what do you think about this idea?
I think there are a lot of tribes who are not recognized that should be. But there's also other groups that are seeking recognition for the wrong reasons. And it would be hard to comment on all of them. My heart goes out to one in particular, and that would be the Chinook tribe, who were recognized one day and the very next terminated by President Bush the Younger, and now are seeking recognition today and should be recognized. We name helicopters after them. We name fish after them. Chinook jargon is the trade language. And they have retained their culture, their heritage, and have been living in the same place forever. Mm-hmm. What has happened to them is a tragedy. They are fighting a losing battle, because once you are terminated, once your case has been heard, you cannot be heard again. It's very difficult to be heard again. We should be fighting for tribes like the Chinook. We should be recognizing that they are truly the descendants of those who were here before others came. And those are the ones that I could comment on. I don't know about all of the other cases, but thank you very much for that question.
Dina Wills, City Club member. At our table, we had Greg Porthra, who is a Native American who was raised in the same area you were. Mm-hmm. And our question concerns Native American children who may have learning disabilities that don't get diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Do you know of research that specifically goes out and looks for these kids and can therefore do something about that?
All right. I know that my father has a learning disability, and he's because his and he functional, but his mother was drank quite a bit during when she was pregnant. Do I know of any research? I do not, but I know alcoholism, drug abuse, all of the things that afflict communities who are socioeconomically challenged affect Native Americans even greater, because we are still recovering from a history that is very, very traumatic, and that just adds on to it. So research, I really don't. Sorry.
John Doyle, City Club member, and question is, how do or would you prefer people to referred to the quote-unquote first peoples, for example, like Indians and Native Americans. Do you have a better suggestion on that?
That's a great, great question. And I do this out of convenience. I always say Indians. And knowing that Columbus got lost and it's a misnomer, he thought he was in India. But I do that out of convenience. And when I was asked this question back in New York, well, why do you say Indian? And I said, well, Think of it this way. You go to Europe and somebody asks you, where are you from? You say, well, I'm from the United States. Oh, where from the United States? Oh, I live on the West Coast. Where on the West Coast? I live in Oregon. And the farther down you go, you find out that I'm from Oregon. I lived on the southern Oregon coast. I live in a town in Coos Bay, and I grew up in South SLU, and I'm Coquel. Well, that should be the rule for all of you. Now that you know that I'm Coquel, I'm not Native American, I'm not American Indian, I'm Coquel. And so as it is okay to say American Indian, Native American, First Nations, it really is. But once you find out that they are from a particular tribe, then it's just as you would introduce yourself to somebody in Europe once they figure out where you are from. All of our names, all of the names that you now hear, Coquel, Chinook, Siletz, all of those names mean people. And they mean people from here. And that's really, I mean, we are, if you want to go even deeper, our Misikotmet Tene. We are people from here, the river called Misi. The eels. So, I mean, that's what those mean. So once you figure out who they are, that's what you refer them to.
That's great. Kathy Ging, City Club member. What do natives think about the proliferation of microwaves in the environment with cell towers, Wi-Fis, and schools, and adversely affecting people, bees, birds, and ducks? 4 to 5 million birds get killed a year just from the cell phone towers, let alone the microwaves. And I'm asking if you know about the Hopi prophecy that said that the U.S. would be contaminated by nuclear radiation except for the Hopi reservation, and there would be an invisible web spread through the country. Do you know what they meant? And then I'm asking if you know about the hemp movement, the industrial hemp movement, Hempbound. He was here last night speaking about industrial hemp, and I'm hoping the Native Americans do a worldwide data bank and land resource bank and who's who of hemp.
What are you going to say? my uncle once introduced me as the smartest man in the room. I said, thank goodness it's all women in here. We should all pay attention to what's happening in the environment. I mean, Native Americans, and I told you a little bit about the first salmon ceremony. It has more to do with preservation than it does actually getting together and eating the first salmon, which, as you know, salmon come up the river, and they come up in big schools, and they sit in one location, and they move up to the, where it rains, they move up to another location. Well, at the mouth of the Coquille River, the river's Coquille, we are Coquille. Every June, we catch that first salmon, and we allow the others to go up. We cook that salmon in the ground for a couple of hours, and then we feed a little bit of that, our cousin, to each one of the tribal members that are there. Then we take the bones, we decorate it with dentalium necklaces and other gifts, and an individual returns the bones to the river, and recognizing the sacrifices that they have made to keep us alive. Well, it's also fish and wildlife management, because there's people up the river that are hungry. And it might have been a hard winter, and they're waiting for those salmon to show up. Also, you are genetically preserving the early returners to spawn first. So we should all pay attention to what is being done to our environment. And Native Americans are exceptionally aware of what's going on. So my response would be very general in that we all have a responsibility, not just Native Americans to point it out or for enlightened ones to point it out. We should all be responsible to what we do to our surroundings, because we're going to have people after us, our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids are going to have to live with the mistakes that we make. So I'm glad we're in Oregon, because I feel guilty when I don't recycle. And when I was in New York, it was an imposition to drag the recycling bins. You know, it's like, oh, recycle through the snow. You know, but if we don't do it out here in New York, you feel guilty, and people will run you out of town almost. Exactly.
Thank you so much for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program honoring the resiliency of American Indians. And thanks again to our sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, Essex General Construction, and Pack Info. We meet again on January 16th at the Downtown Athletic Club for an opportunity agenda for Oregonians with special guest speaker Tina Kotek, Speaker of the House, Oregon State Legislature. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thanks all so much for being with us today.